can regular people do in this country to deal with the concerns you've just expressed?
Well, I think people really are getting a lot more engaged in these issues. There is this fallacy in Washington that people do not care about money and politics issues. I think it could not be more untrue. I think we're seeing it play out in this election cycle where candidates on both sides of the aisle are making this a signature issue, money and politics and the undue influence of the very wealthy on not only who gets elected, but what policies get adopted after the election is over. And people are responding. People are turning out and showing their concern on this issue. I think people have to continue to raise this issue with their elected officials and to tell them that they really do care. We had, when we opened the door to comments, we had overwhelming responses from the public, thousands and thousands of comments that overwhelmingly supported our taking stronger action, providing more rules, providing clear guidance.
I want to thank you very much for joining us, Federal Election Commissioner Ellen Weintraub. And that does it for our show. We're beginning our 100-city 20th anniversary tour. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. I'll be in Ithaca College April 6th. That's Wednesday. Columbus, Ohio at Ohio State University on the 8th. St. Louis, Columbia, Missouri and Kansas City on the 9th. Los Angeles Times Book Festival in Santa Barbara on the 10th. After that, in San Francisco at City Arts and Lectures on the 11th. Stanford University and then Santa Clara on the 12th. Santa Cruz on the 13th. Check out democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke. Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wales, Walter Gardens-Diener. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, or also heard on the web at www.kbu.fm. The time is 5 o'clock. Stay tuned for the Tuesday evening news. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the League of Women Voters of Portland, presenting a forum for Portland Mayor on Thursday, April 14th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah County Building Boardroom, 501 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. This forum is in partnership with the Buckman Community Association. More voter information at lwvpdx.org.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Climate Change Tools for Faith Communities, a workshop led by Tim DeChristopher, Saturday, April 9th, starting at 10 a.m., at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. During this day-long workshop, Sewell Lecture Speaker Tim DeChristopher will share integrated and multi-faith strategies to prevent climate change and environmental injustice, combat poverty, and restore dignity to both people and the planet. Again, that's a Climate Change Tools for Faith Communities, a workshop led by Tim DeChristopher, Saturday, April 9th at 10 a.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1211 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tune in Tuesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. for The Melting Pot, featuring DJs, producers, and electronic artists from around the globe. Win tickets and stay up on events each and every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. on The Melting Pot, right here at 90.7 FM KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, in Mississippi and North Carolina, many constituents and lawmakers are outraged after a discriminatory anti-LGBTQ legislation was signed into effect.
This weekend, a grassroots organization is ready to take you hiking to explain local issues. We speak live to BARC.
The Inner City Blues Festival on April 16th benefits advocates of a single-payer healthcare system. We sit down with an advocate to discuss systemic changes in U.S. healthcare. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 5th, 2016. I'm Kanan Schlesinger.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. 8-year-old Terrence Burton Jr. and his family were on the KBOO Evening News last Friday night talking about their annual fundraiser for hungry kids and families. KBOO reporter Jamie Haddad spoke with Terrence and his mother, Rochelle Hart, about the event. We wanted to bring you an update on that. The 2016 Terrence Feed raised almost $1,000 last Saturday. This is what they had to say last week.
I got it in a store at Walmart, as in Walmart, and I said, "Hey, Mom, is it really true that people eat out trash cans?" And she said, "Yeah, it is." And I didn't like that, so I started the hand feed for if that wouldn't happen.
And how old were you when you started this?
4.
And how old are you now?
8.
How many events have you held so far?
3. This is my 3rd year, going into my 3rd year.
Who do you hope to help with this event?
I think the target audience for Terrence is people that are dealing with hunger and homelessness, and a lot of times those things commingle. So both of those, this year specifically, he is donating 100% of the funds to My Father's House, which is a shelter, which I pause when I say that only because it's such a dignified place that I think it's almost an injustice to refer to it as a shelter because it's done so well. And so 100% of the proceeds will be going to My Father's House. And in a nutshell, they focus on families that are transitioning from the streets. They actually house them in apartment-like domains, provide all of the needs from job training to meals to childcare. I mean, it's a complete comprehensive program. Then folks can actually transition to townhouses that are owned by My Father's House, and they can rent them at below market value while they're rebuilding their financial situation. How Terrence learned of that particular organization is the first year he gave the money to the Portland Rescue Mission, you know, one of the most commonly known agencies. But Terrence is also into Taekwondo. He's testing for his black belt this year. And as a subgroup of that, he's on the leadership team, pretty elite group of kids and adults who are kind of the cream of the crop amongst that crew of people. And they do a lot of community outreach because it's all about being a leader and a stand-up person on and off the mat. So the leadership team organized a birthday party for children living at My Father's House who otherwise may not have a birthday party. So when we got there, Terrence was beyond wowed by this organization and how they operated. And then we got to, I believe it's the 3rd floor, and he recognized that they have a floor exclusively for single fathers. And that is such an underserved group of people when you are talking about populations that are hungry and homeless. And so that day when we left, he said, "Mom, when I do the next Terrence feed, this is where I want the money to go."
Terrence, what would you say to other kids who get a pretty big idea, and some of them might even be listening to today's show? What advice would you give them?
If you want to help others, help them. Follow your dream.
Accessibility and widespread sharing of data generated by the city is at stake in the upcoming comprehensive plan revisions, according to the investigative reporting nonprofit blog Investigate West. Chris Smith, a representative of the Portland Planning Commission, is said to be, quote, "pressing the city of Portland to make open data a priority in its upcoming comprehensive plan." In 2009, under former Mayor Sam Adams, Portland signed into a national policy called the Open Data Plan. Officials created a civic apps page on the city's website to help taxpayers learn more about how their money is spent. Today, that page is all but abandoned. Investigate West reports that the city's comprehensive plan updating process is stripping out requirements about public data disclosure and replacing them with, quote, "suggested disclosures," quote, "when appropriate." Investigate West says the City of Portland's Office of Management and Finance is a major culprit in the pushback of the public's right to know. A public spokeswoman there told Investigate West, quote, "the possibility of future misunderstanding could be huge."
A new agreement is set to be announced by Governor Kate Brown during a ceremony on Yurok tribal land in California that may result in the removal of 4 dams from the Klamath Basin, a move that would help restore the Klamath River. Just this past February, Governor Brown and U.S. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell completed a deal with utility company PacifiCorp to remove aging dams that were not producing significant amounts of hydroelectric power, but were blocking salmon from their spawning grounds. The agreements to remove these dams could settle decades of disputes among tribes, ranchers, farmers, and environmentalists over water and land rights. Tribal leaders that rely on the Klamath River were happy to see forward movement on this plan. The chairman of the Yurok tribe stated, quote, That's our livelihood. If the river is sick, our fish are sick. The animals that live around it become sick, and the people become sick. Farmers and irrigators are concerned that they may need to install costly screens to keep salmon out of irrigation pumps and canals, but Oregon, Washington, and the federal government have agreed to pay for equipment to divert fish from irrigation channels. A final restoration pact is still not a certainty, as such agreement was stalled in Congress last year when Republicans balked over the proposed plan for the dams, and was further complicated by disputes between tribes and farm groups. The current plan still needs final approval from federal regulators, but removal of the dams is expected to start in 2020.
Every month, the grassroots organization BARC holds a special hiking event where local residents climb on board a vehicle in the Portland area and ride out to an important nature area. There, everyone takes a few hours to hike around and get in touch with the natural world. Then they get plugged into an important effort to preserve that area. Here to talk about the program are Brady Hall and Gary Wiseman. Thanks for being with us today.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Where is this month's BARC hike?
This month we're going to the site of the 36 Pit Fire that burned in Clackamas Watershed south of Estacada last year.
So what's going on in that spot? Like, why do people need to be active in protecting this area you're going to?
Well, we've been protecting this spot for years now. I think since 2009 is when it started. First for a logging cell, and then after the fire happened, in a salvage logging cell. So we've been fighting to protect this part of the forest for many years now, and it's a really interesting area. I'd love to show some people.
Maybe we should explain what salvage logging is.
Yeah, go ahead.
Right. Okay. So salvage logging is after a fire burns through, they go in to salvage the big economic value of the trees and remove them from the landscape, which is not a very good idea if you want healthy forest to return there. So
snags that exist after a fire are actually like apartment buildings for animals, and
Sorry, I have a little technical difficulties there.
Yeah, you guys are just going to need to share that microphone.
Okay. Snags that exist after a fire has burned are like apartment buildings for animals. They're basically a vital part of the ecosystem, and if you cut them down, you lose that. Burned areas are often, well, they're arguably more biodiverse even than old growth areas. They have a lot of things going on.
So why did you all decide to launch the hikes? And what sort of response do you see from participants who are perhaps like going on these hikes for the first time and learning about these areas for the first time?
Well, our hikes are meant to provide access to the public that may have a hard time getting out there themselves. It's really special to live in an urban environment with such a beautiful, you know, national forest right on our doorstep. So if we can help people get out there, that's great. And also to raise awareness about what's going on, and also just to get the community involved in stuff we think's important.
So how do you guys decide where your hikes will be?
Well, there's a lot of different ways. There's a few times of year we have special hikes. Like every October, we have a very popular mushroom hike. Every January or February, we do tracking with Cascadia Wild. Most months, though, we keep flexible and try to adapt depending on what's going on in the forest, whether it's a logging cell that there's a comment period coming up on, or just something cool in the forest that we want to show people.
Thanks.
So what kind of people do you take on the hikes? Is the demographic pretty wide? Do you try to bring anyone who's interested, or do you work with organizations on a recurring basis?
Absolutely anyone that wants to come is welcome. Sometimes we do work with other organizations like Cascadia Wild. Kids are welcome, although we do hike off trail. So keep that in mind. And also, because we go off trail, dogs aren't allowed.
Okay.
Yeah.
You don't want them scaring the wildlife.
Harming the off-trail habitat of the forest floor.
So would you describe these hikes as kind of difficult? Do you have to be in shape to go on these hikes?
No, I wouldn't say that. Certainly not for most of them. It just basic off trail, you know, you won't be on a nice groomed trail for most of the hikes. I wouldn't say it's strenuous or difficult.
So what typically happens on a bark hike?
Well, we meet up, carpool out to the forest, and we still meet at Trader Joe's at 9 a.m. second Sunday of every month.
Which Trader Joe's is that?
In Hollywood. It's Trader Joe's in Hollywood. And we go out to wherever we are in the forest, sometimes meet other people from other places like Mount Hood or Estacada, and we just go out to the forest and just talk about it and learn together, really.
So it's pretty much like a meetup basis then? So people can just show up, or do you ask that they kind of get in touch with you to...
Oh, they
register.
They can just show up, absolutely.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
It's also an amazing service that BARC provides, because there are people that do this kind of thing that charge a lot of money for it, and BARC does it for free, and anyone can participate. So.
So can you tell us a little bit about just the organization of BARC? What is your mission?
Our mission is just to protect and restore Mount Hood National Forest specifically, but really all of our natural resources, from water to land, ecosystem services.
So Gary, actually, you were mentioning that you were the artist in residence for BARC?
Yeah, over the summer.
Uh-huh. So what did that mean? What did you do for BARC?
What did I do for them? Well, my job was basically to respond to their mission, which Brady just stated. I did three projects for them. One of them was directly related to 36 Pit, which is why we're here to talk about the 36 Pit fire hike. In 2014, there was a very large burn there. You may have heard about it on the news. Well, in terms of burns, it wasn't really that big, but it's one of the largest ones that has happened recently in Mount Hood National Forest. And I went out to the forest with the ground truthing teams and collected charcoal from the forests and then refined it and processed it and made inks and paints and all kinds of different mediums out of that, and then painted the burn perimeters of the forest, of the areas that were burned that I had collected the charcoal from. So it's a little bit confusing, but
wow.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. That sounds very interesting. Where could people see that art? Is it available on BARC's website?
I think it's up there. You could go to, if you go to Oregon Arts Watch, there's an article about it. The website, it's just Oregon Arts Watch.
Oh, nice.
And put in my name, Gary Wiseman, and it will come up.
And so, Brady, what is your position with BARC, and what do you do with them?
I try to do as much as I can, honestly. I love leading the hikes. That's a really fun time to interact with people and educate people. I'm also on the Forest Watch Committee to help a group of volunteers that helps determine how to react and what to prioritize in Mount Hood National Forest.
So if people want to find out more about BARC, how can people find out stuff about you guys?
Well, you can go to our website, join our email list is definitely a good idea.
What's your website address?
bark-out.org.
And are you guys on social media at all?
Absolutely. Joining our Facebook's a great way to keep up on events like these hikes and our ecology nights, and we're going to have a bunch of events coming up this summer. So
everything's documented on the Flickr page too.
Oh, you have a Flickr page. Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. Well, that's about all the time we have for the interview. Brady and Gary, thank you so much for taking the time coming in and educating us on BARC.
It's my pleasure.
Thanks.
Awesome organization.
The website is bark-out.org.
Awesome. Thanks.
Go visit it, everyone. Late in March, DW Pharmaceuticals announced the first of its clinical trials of a new drug intended to treat Dravet syndrome, a rare debilitating form of epilepsy. The drug is unique in that it's the only thing that scientists and doctors have found that treats all the symptoms of Dravet symptoms and reduces the frequency of seizures. It's received media attention because its chief ingredient is CBD, an active cannabinoid found in marijuana. KBOO reporter Kanan Schlesinger interviewed Steve Schultz at the pharmaceutical company GW for more insight.
Hey, my name is Steve Schultz, and I'm the Vice President of Investor Relations for GW Pharmaceuticals. Dravet syndrome is a severe infantile onset and highly treatment-resistant form of epilepsy, and it's frequently associated with a genetic mutation in the sodium channels. Although not all Dravet patients have that sodium channel gene mutation, it is a clinical diagnosis. Onset of Dravet syndrome occurs during the first year of life, generally in previously healthy and developmentally normal infants, and approximately 5% of all childhood epilepsies in the first year of life, or about 5,000 to 6,000 children in the United States in total, have Dravet syndrome. And there are currently no FDA-approved medicines for Dravet syndrome. This Epidiolex, if approved, would be the first. The initial seizures are severe, long-lasting, and over time, patients with Dravet syndrome can develop multiple types of seizures, including convulsive seizures, and they're prone to bouts of prolonged seizures that are called status epilepticus, and those types of seizures can be life-threatening. GW has been testing our product Epidiolex, which is a pure CBD, CBD being one of the chemicals in the cannabis plant, and we've been testing this now for about 7 years, preclinically, starting in preclinically against using it against different types of epilepsy and seizure models, and then moving into the clinic.
So I want to back up really quickly and go back to CBD. When did CBD enter, or cannabidiol enter the picture in treating epilepsy? And how did the pharmaceutical company you work for become aware of its potentially life-alleviating effects?
Well, CBD and cannabinoids in general have been understood as therapeutics for a couple of thousand years. I mean, the history of the use of cannabis as a therapeutic, you know, goes back a long time. So there's a fair amount of documentation of the use of cannabinoids against a variety of different therapeutic targets. GW began about 20 years ago, really as the, you know, one of the first companies in the world to formally explore the use of these cannabinoids, or the chemicals in the plant, for a very specific therapeutic use. Most recently, I think CBD use in epilepsy emerged as there were parents of patients, mainly in the United States, that were looking into the use of cannabinoids for epilepsy, mainly in their children, and came across publications and scientific literature that was generated by GW Pharmaceuticals and some other sources as well. And I think that around 2012, 2013 began, you know, the significant recent interest in looking at CBD as a way to manage seizures in treatment-resistant patients.
So what do you hope to achieve through these trials? And I guess specifically I'm talking about the availability of Epidiolex and CBD to families struggling with Dravet syndrome and other forms of epilepsy and other ailments that really make CBD an appealing treatment option.
Absolutely. Our objective is quite clear, and that is to gain FDA approval of Epidiolex for the use in the types of epilepsy that we've been studying. And this would make the drug available universally, so in every state in the union, and legal for use in every state in the union, and would provide those families that are struggling with how to access CBD medicine for their children or for themselves if they're older patients. We think that this is the right route and the right solution for those patients.
I'm speaking with Steve Schultz, the Vice President of Investor Relations with GW Pharmaceuticals. They're developing a CBD-based product that's derived from the cannabis plant. Steve, I really thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Okay, and thank you for the opportunity to share information about our company and our product Epidiolex with your audience.
The mayor of Atlanta is the latest to join the ban on travel to North Carolina in light of the state's new anti-LGBT law, House Bill 2. Local news outlets report Atlanta Mayor Kasem Reed announced Monday he has ordered city employees to halt non-essential trips to North Carolina because of what he called, quote, discriminatory and unnecessary legislation, end quote. Every person, regardless of their gender, gender expression, or sexuality, is a valued member of our community, said Reed in his statement to the press. The Atlanta travel ban follows similar actions by the mayors of Portland, the District of Columbia, San Francisco, and Seattle. The Boston City Council and the governors of Washington, New York, Connecticut, and Minnesota.
In the wake of the passage of North Carolina's new anti-LGBT law, PayPal has pulled out of a planned expansion into the state. PayPal was planning to open a new global payment center in Charlotte that was expected to shower 400 new jobs upon the much-lauded city. Republican Governor Pat McCrory had celebrated PayPal's scheduled expansion just days before he signed the law that repeals LGBT-inclusive non-discrimination protections statewide and requires transgender people to use public facilities that do not match their gender identity. The new law perpetuates discrimination, and it violates the values and principles that are at the core of PayPal's mission and culture, read in part a statement posted today by PayPal CEO Dan Schulman. The Associated Press framed PayPal's canceled expansion as, quote, the biggest tangible economic backlash to a state law that in more than 100 corporations have decried as unfair.
Coming up next is Trans Positive, a brand new show hosted by Emma Lugo at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather is going to be a bit cloudy with a low of 42. Tomorrow will be sunny with a high of 76 and just a few passing clouds. Today in history, on 1922, the precursor to Planned Parenthood, the American Birth Control League, was incorporated into New York state law. The organization promoted the founding of birth control clinics, primarily for Black and Latino communities. The quote of the day is, "Diplomats make it their business to conceal the facts," by Margaret Sanger, founder of the American Birth Control League.
Turkey decriminalized homosexuality in 1858 and gives asylum to lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people from other countries escaping persecution. But its modern penal code continues to discriminate, giving lighter sentences to perpetrators who commit crimes against their community. Activists are fighting for constitutional protection and acceptance in a society that considers being gay or trans as taboo. Fariba Nawa reports from Istanbul.
The walls of the LGBT Solidarity Association in central Istanbul are bright green and filled with political graffiti. Board member Kıvılcım Arat sits in front of a pink table, rolling up a cigarette with her slender fingers tipped with bright red nails. Arat says the struggle for LGBTs in Turkey has a long way to go, but since the massive Taksim Square protests against the Turkish government's overdevelopment and conservatism in 2013, other minorities and mainstream Turks have joined the fight for their rights. One of the main goals of LGBT activists is to have sexual orientation and gender identity recognized and protected in the Turkish constitution. Arat from the LGBT Association.
The LGBT movement has five fundamental demands for rights. One of them is to include sexual orientation and gender identity terms to Article 10 of the Constitution, which defines the equal treatment principle. The second one is to enact a law on hate crimes. This is very important because LGBTs in Turkey are exposed to hate crimes. They get killed in hate murders. The third one is to define sex work as a profession. The fourth one is to remove lighter sentences for perpetrators of hate crimes in the legal system. The fifth one is to open a safe environment for sex workers.
Activists from different NGOs and groups took a bus to Ankara to voice their demands to the Turkish General Assembly last year. The ruling Conservative Justice and Development Party, or AKP, doesn't support them, but two other political parties took on their cause and opened discussion in parliament for a week. The finale was a blow. The AKP and another party killed the proposal. But LGBTs have made strides. Reforms in Turkish cities allowing for them to be out and expressive include the opening of many cafes. The Chaplin Cafe flies its rainbow flag over its balcony in historic central Istanbul. Posters of Charlie Chaplin adorn the walls and Turkish music blasts from the speakers. This is one of about a dozen cafes openly serving the LGBT community in the city. These cafes, which serve food and drinks, have popped up in the last decade as voices of the community have become stronger. 23-year-old Uğur Karasu is the manager.
We're trying to create an environment that LGBT members can feel comfortable in. We're trying to create an environment that they can come with their lovers and hold hands, that they can feel comfortable, that they can speak freely. This is not quite possible outside. People can react negatively towards us at normal hetero venues.
But that openness is limited to these few public spaces. Attitudes toward the LGBT community have become more accepting, but a deep homophobia lingers. 13 years ago, LGBT activists began an annual gay pride parade in Istanbul, but last summer, police disbanded the parade with rubber bullets, water cannons, and tear gas because it was during the Islamic holy month of Ramadan. Many of Turkey's Muslim population believe Islam forbids homosexuality. A few blocks from the cafe where the parade takes place in Taksim Square, street vendors sell sesame-covered bread, corn, and roasted chestnuts. Hakan arranges his chestnuts and shakes his head when asked about LGBTs.
Islam doesn't accept this. How can it be right? It has no place in Islam, and as it has no place in Islam, it's a big sin. I say it's a big sin. Frankly, I never looked at them. I don't want to see them.
These homophobic attitudes are the real problem, not Islam, says Suma, who fled Egypt to Turkey after he was attacked and his friend was killed for being gay in Cairo. A former businessman and current founder of Tea and Talk, an LGBT group for Arab refugees in Turkey, Suma is waiting for asylum to a third country where he can feel safe as an LGBT member. He says he's one of about 560 LGBT refugees in Turkey, and they all want to go to the West.
Actually, the people are staring in a very aggressive way. Nobody likes me to sit near to him in the bus as if I'm a plague. Some people, when they just look at me, they move away from me. They're afraid of being infected or something like this. One time, one young man, if I may say, was very aggressive to me in the subway. And he tried to beat me. That's why I stayed off the subway. But I had to get off the metro. Otherwise, he was going to attack me. And the people was laughing in the car.
But Suma isn't deterred. He tries to help his community through tea and talk. Just last week, with his organization's help, a judge ordered police to investigate who assaulted an LGBT refugee man by viewing the street security camera where the incident occurred. The judge told the victim he could sue police for refusing to file a report. Whether a refugee or native LGBT, it's a daily battle to be out in Turkey. Despite the hard work of activists, legal protection for the community in the country's constitution will not become a reality anytime soon. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Fariba Noah in Istanbul.
Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif denied allegations against his administration and defend the nation's honor on Tuesday. Sharif set up a commission to investigate the allegations based on leaked documents from Panama, which suggests that offshore companies headed by members of his family have been dodging taxes and disgusting financial assets. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists said that these companies were involved in the purchase and mortgage of at least $13.8 million in UK properties. Political opponents in Pakistan, notably Imran Khan, have accused Sharif's family of having gained the funds illegally through corruption during his two previous stints as prime minister in the 1990s.
Prime Minister of Iceland is the first to resign in the wake of the Panama Papers scandal. The news editor of the Reykjavik Grapevine, Paul Fontaine, reported that, quote, "Iceland's PM is not an isolated incident. We need to look not only at individual players, but the system itself. The greater crime, which the Panama Papers illustrate comprehensively, is that we have a secret economy connected to and even supporting some of the worst aspects of the global capitalist system."
Now it's time for a community rights commentary from Paul Cienfuegos.
Greetings. You are listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Last Saturday, I attended the Community Air Forum at Revolution Hall in Portland, sponsored by the Eastside Portland Air Coalition. Alarmingly high levels of arsenic, cadmium, hexavalent chromium, and other toxic chemicals have been found in the air and soil of two local neighborhoods, with more toxic hot spots being discovered every month. The situation in some of our neighborhoods is so bad that Portland is now considered to be the third most polluted city in the U.S. I'm going to repeat that last sentence. The situation in some of our neighborhoods is so bad that Portland is now considered to be the third most polluted city in the U.S. That's not exactly the story most Americans might imagine when they think about Portland as a green city, but the facts say otherwise. Aaron Brockovich was in town to give the keynote speech, and an impressive speech it was. Brockovich is best known for her role uncovering toxic contamination of groundwater by Pacific Gas and Electric Corporation in Hinckley, California in 1993. Her story was turned into an award-winning movie starring Julia Roberts in 2000. Seven other people gave brief presentations, all of them fascinating and filled with quite scary information about the state of our air and soil here in Portland. I left this extraordinary event with a feeling of dread in my belly, not because the situation here is bad, which it is, not because the regulatory agencies have been proven once again to have ignored the problem for decades, which they have, but because the energetic people who are leading this heroic effort to deal with this environmental scandal do not yet fully comprehend the structural changes that will be necessary to solve this poisoning problem.
One speaker referred to the Department of Environmental Quality, or DEQ, as having been captured by industry. I wish it were that simple. In fact, industry didn't have to capture our regulatory agencies because industry actually helped to design our regulatory agencies. The Department of Environmental Quality, the Oregon Health Authority, and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency are the regulatory agencies that have allowed the poisoning of Portland's air and soil for decades. Regulatory law was originally invented in the late 1800s when the U.S. Attorney met privately when the U.S. Attorney General met privately with the leaders of the railroad corporations to create the nation's first regulatory agency, which he described as, quote, a sort of barrier between the railroad corporations and the people, unquote. The public was to be pacified with laws that sounded tough, but placed much discretion in the hands of regulators. This new system of law worked so well to shield the railroad industry from public outrage that over the decades that followed, every major industrial sector demanded and got its own regulatory agency. In other words, regulatory law is corporate turf. My colleague Jane Ann Morris loves to say that the primary purpose of environmental regulations is to regulate environmentalists, not to prevent harm to the environment. And anyone who has ever testified at a regulatory hearing knows that she's absolutely right. Regulatory law does have one other significant purpose. It normalizes harmful corporate activities by establishing a so-called safe level of harm as defined by experts. The granting of the regulatory permit is the authorization to cause harm, and that harm is considered a constitutionally protected property right of a corporate person. Believe me, I'm not making this up. So what's the solution here in Portland? Step one is for the Eastside Portland Air Coalition to refocus its attention away from pleading with agency directors who are by design not directly accountable to us, and instead envisioning what could be achieved if we, the people of Portland, started to exercise our inherent self-governing authority by passing local ballot initiatives that prohibit corporations from poisoning us. Through a local ballot initiative, we could ban any release of cadmium, arsenic, or hexavalent chromium and guarantee to all local residents their right to clean air and soil. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania City Council passed such a community rights ordinance a number of years ago. The Pittsburgh Ordinance establishes the right of Pittsburgh residents, natural communities, and ecosystems to be free from toxic trespass. It holds corporations, federal, state, and local governments and agencies liable for such toxic trespass. And it defines toxic trespass as, quote, the involuntary presence of toxic or potentially toxic chemicals and substances within a human body, natural community, or ecosystem, unquote. Imagine how much more effective we, the people of Portland, could be in ending this corporate poisoning of our neighborhoods if we exercised our inherent right to govern ourselves rather than merely pleading with regulatory agency directors or our governor to address this crisis. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KBOO Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my community rights updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at cienfuegospaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tony Latigre, Jenna Yokoyama, and Dominic Anaya. The producer is Kanan Schlesinger. Special thanks to Paul Cienfuegos and Jim Thompson. Our engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of local stories from the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/evening news. Or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Jenny Okuyama.
And I'm Kanan Schlesinger. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday, talk radio host Paul Roland speaks with climate activist Tim DeChristopher, who is coming to Portland to speak on the terrible uncertainties thrust upon us by growing climate instability. At 9, on Political Perspectives, host Per Fagerang speaks with Adam Hochschild about his new book, Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936 through 1939, sweeping history of the Spanish Civil War. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's the KBOO Bike Show, bringing you news and views of cycling in Portland and beyond. This has been the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for news in depth. Good night, Jenna.
Good night, Kanan.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
For News in Depth, Kanan Schlesinger spoke today with Dr. Sam Metz with